John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for not, oh no, my phone's just sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, April 4th, 2012. Israeli shelling targeting Gaza leaves a teenager dead, and West Bank settlers refuse to leave a Palestinian house and face eviction by the military. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian teenager was found dead on Wednesday midday near the Israeli borders with Gaza City after he was wounded by military shelling to the area last night. Medical sources announced that Hisham Saeed, 17, died after he was injured last night and bled until Wednesday morning. On Tuesday night, Israeli tanks stationed at the borders bombarded a Shuja'iya neighborhood in Gaza City. At the time of the shelling, no one could reach the area to make sure no civilians were injured, local sources in Gaza reported. Also on the Gaza Strip today, Israel allowed fuel into the coastal enclave via Kerem Abu Salem crossing between the Gaza Strip and Israel. According to the Coordination Committee for the Channeling Goods into the Gaza Strip, a total of 500,000 liters of industrial fuel was allowed in today. The industrial fuel is going to be used by Gaza Power Plant to generate electricity to the 1.5 million residents living in the Strip. In recent months, Gaza residents had to endure power cuts up to 13 hours a day due to fuel shortages. In the West Bank on Wednesday, the Israeli army started to evacuate a house owned by Palestinians that was taken over by settlers last week. The house is located in the old city of Hebron, southern West Bank. The property in question is located near the Ibrahimi Mosque in the old city. The settlers claim that they purchased the property by legal means, but the owners, living in the first floor of the building, denied the claim and challenged it in court. On Tuesday, Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu asked his defense minister Ehud Barak to delay the eviction of settlers. However, the military gave the settlers until today midday to leave the house or face eviction after saying that the settlers took over the house without coordinating with the military civil administration. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, April 4th Daily News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. Please join us again tomorrow for more news and updates. Visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
Afghanistan today. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unspecified nationality from an IED blast in an undisclosed area of southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan today. NATO is reporting the deaths of two soldiers of unspecified nationality from an IED blast in an undisclosed area of northern Afghanistan. Afghanistan yesterday. NATO is reporting the deaths of two soldiers of unspecified nationality from IED blasts in undisclosed areas in eastern Afghanistan. Afghanistan yesterday. Taliban militants set fire to another convoy of NATO tankers carrying fuel for U.S.-led foreign forces, according to Press TV. Afghan officials admitted to 6 tanker trucks destroyed. The Taliban claimed 9. A similar ambush last week destroyed 5 NATO fuel tankers. Dozens of Taliban fighters were gunned down in the resulting battles. Afghanistan, Monday. 4 policemen and 2 civilians were poisoned and killed in a police checkpoint Monday night in Helmand Province, a provincial government spokesman reported Tuesday. The Washington Post reports that the food was poisoned. Pakistan, Friday. A suspected U.S. drone fired 2 missiles at a house in northwest Pakistan early Friday morning, killing 4 alleged militants. Afghanistan today. A suicide bomber on a motorcycle killed at least 10 people and wounded 26 in Maimana, the capital of Faryab province, according to officials and police. Mr. Barack Obama, so far this year, 96 NATO service members have been killed in Afghanistan, including at least 52 Americans. Meanwhile, nothing else changes on the ground. Now's the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops home today. Mr. Barack Obama, if you're thinking you're fighting to protect women from the Taliban, think again. Here's a report from Between the Lines about how women are being treated by the current Afghan government.
According to Human Rights Watch, 400 women and girls in Afghanistan are in jail for crimes like fleeing domestic violence and forced marriages. Women and girls are also regularly convicted of the crime known as zina, or having sex outside of marriage, often only on the word of an aggrieved husband or family member. In 2009, Afghanistan passed a law that banned violence against women. However, it's rarely enforced by judges or prosecutors. Human rights advocates recount cases where women have gone to the police seeking protection from an abuser, only to be arrested for the crime of running away from their husbands. Since the U.S. overthrew the Taliban regime in 2001, Western governments have spent billions of dollars to modernize Afghanistan and to improve the status of women and girls. Today, over 2.4 million girls are enrolled in school, yet only 12.5% of Afghan women can read, and few women have an understanding of their new constitutional rights. In a recent high-profile abuse case, a woman known as Gulnaz was jailed after she had been raped and made pregnant by a relative. She won a pardon from Afghan President Karzai after her plight won international attention. But the woman said she planned to marry the man who raped her in order to avoid the social stigma associated with having a child outside of wedlock. President Karzai, who recently sought closer ties to Afghanistan's conservative Islamic community, publicly supported a decree by a group of government-sponsored religious leaders that declared women to be worth less than men, should not leave the house without a male escort, nor should they mix with men at school or in the workplace.
Is that what U.S. troops are defending from the Taliban? Is that what U.S. troops and Afghan civilians are dying for? Or are you just fighting to build a goddamn gas pipeline through Afghanistan? Mr. Barack Obama, now is the time to pull the plug on this senseless war.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
The tragic February 26 shooting death of unarmed 17-year-old Trayvon Martin by a volunteer neighborhood watch captain in Sanford, Florida, has focused the nation's attention on the issue of racial profiling and its sometimes lethal consequences. The fact that the shooter, 28-year-old George Zimmerman, has not been arrested, despite having a record of being previously arrested for assaulting a police officer in 2005 and a history of domestic violence, adds to the feeling of many in Florida and around the country that race played a role in how the police responded to the case. Although the facts surrounding the shooting are in dispute, what has angered communities of color in Sanford and across the U.S. is that the police department failed to pursue even a rudimentary investigation or collect evidence in the case until their inaction provoked outrage and protests from coast to coast. As the national spotlight descended on Sanford, the town's police chief, Bill Lee, who has since resigned temporarily, told the press that under Florida's Stand Your Ground law, police could not arrest Zimmerman without evidence to contradict his story that he shot Trayvon Martin in self-defense. But authorities are at a loss to explain why, on an initial police incident report filed by officers at the scene of the shooting, the case was described as homicide, negligent manslaughter, unnecessary killing to prevent an unlawful act. With protests drawing increasing attention to police inaction in Martin's death, Florida's Governor Rick Scott appointed a special prosecutor in the case, while attorneys representing the dead teenager's parents have called for the U.S. Justice Department to get involved. Your reporter spoke with Jin-Hee Lee, assistant counsel with the Criminal Justice Practice Group at the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. She discusses the wider issues of racial profiling seen in the Martin case and examines the consequences of Stand Your Ground and other lax gun laws.
One of the main concerns that we have here at the Legal Defense Fund, and especially in the Criminal Justice Practice Group, has been the criminalization of people of color. And when I say that, what I mean is the assumptions and prejudices and stereotypes of assuming that a person who is primarily black or Latino is being having criminal tendencies, that they're more likely to be a criminal. And this is a result of longstanding racism in our criminal justice institutions. It's also evident in media perceptions of black and Latinos, especially young black and Latino men. And the consequences can be very tragic, as what happened to Trayvon Martin.
As you look at the facts of this case, where there has to date been no arrests of George Zimmerman here in this case, tell us about the reasons you think there has been no arrest here. Some point to Florida's Stand Your Ground law as a justification for the police not taking action. But it appears in some recent news reports that there had been an initial police report requesting an arrest warrant for negligent homicide and unnecessary manslaughter. But apparently people higher up in the system basically knocked that idea down.
And the fact that the way that this case has been handled is a real reflection, again, of common perceptions, common misperceptions, and, again, stereotypes of people like Trayvon Martin, because at the end of the day, he was, you know, a 17-year-old who was carrying Skittles and a can of iced tea, and to be gunned down on the street, and for there to be no repercussions for that, and for people to kind of assume that the killing, or even to, as the Sanford police has put forward, that this killing was justified, kind of belies the fact that what we had here was a student. The automatic impression of who this person was is an innocent student who was walking home at night from a grocery store, from a convenience store. And instead, to even presume that this killing was justified automatically taints the impression of this young man as someone who was dangerous or was putting George Zimmerman at risk of danger. And again, this really kind of highlights the ingrained stereotypes that we have of young black men like Trayvon Martin.
Jin-Hee Lee, tell us about the particulars of the accusations that the Sanford Police Department are guilty of some very sloppy investigative work here in terms of looking into the background of George Zimmerman, the shooter in this case, who killed Trayvon Martin, and the lack of questions to some key witnesses, including Trayvon Martin's girlfriend, who was on a cell phone with him just minutes before he was shot and killed.
Yeah, absolutely. There's been a lot of criticisms about the way the police has handled this, and especially when you think about the seriousness of what happened, that a young person was shot and killed, and for them to not take the investigation seriously and to take all steps to figure out what happened and to preserve evidence and to question George Zimmerman right away, right after the incident, all of those things, it's an unfortunate indication of how little the police valued Trayvon Martin's life, that that he was a victim in that situation, and that it was their responsibility to really determine what happened to him that night.
Jin Healy, the National Rifle Association, a very powerful lobby in Washington and in state capitals, along with ALEC, a national group that's sponsored by corporate organizations like Coca-Cola and ExxonMobil, are the ones that are pushing the weakening of concealed gun laws and stand your ground laws from Florida and all across this country. What's your view of these laws and why they're being pushed so aggressively by these corporate backers and the NRA?
No, I can't possibly understand what their agenda is or why it is that they're pursuing these types of legislation. What I can say is that when that type of legislation is enacted in jurisdictions across the country, because they are embedded in a criminal justice system that is and has been inherently racist towards people of color, and when I say that, I mean that there is a lot of institutional discrimination against the Black and Latino communities when it comes to law enforcement. These types of statutes and laws just exacerbate the problem and create situations like we had with Trayvon Martin, where it gives institutions an additional excuse to not value the lives of our young Black and Latino men.
That was Jin Healy, assistant counsel with the Criminal Justice Practice Group at the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Find more analysis of the Martin case and racial profiling on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
On the 29th of March, representatives of the NAACP, the Urban League, and many other groups showed up in front of the D.C. headquarters of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange, located at 1101 Vermont Avenue, to protest ALEC's status as the author of both Florida's Stand Your Ground Law, the law under which Trayvon Martin was killed, and while they're at it, to protest against voter ID laws that make it harder for Black and brown people to change this kind of legislation. Here's what Hillary Shelton of the NAACP had to say.
Sadly, we are gathered here today because yet again what we're seeing in America is an issue of racial profiling in which a young man, African-American, 17 years of age, was stopped by an overly engaged, outrageously racist that decided that because this young man was African-American and wearing a hoodie, somehow or another, some of our commentators are suggesting the hoodie was the black. But we know that for some reason or another, I remember a whole lot of other folks wearing hoodies. I've enjoyed all the Rocky movies, and Rocky wore hoodies. I wear a hoodie, AFL-CIO wears hoodies. Sweatshirts are not the issue. Racial profiling is the issue. But racial profiling in this case, when you're able to block it and actually implement your insidious task of actually punishing, or in this case, killing an African American for being an African American, and then being able to hide behind the so-called stand your ground laws, makes a tragedy an outrage. Yes. Outrage.
The president of the Urban League had this to say.
We've come to pull back the curtain so that the world can meet the team of ghostwriters. Ghostwriters who have written these kill at will laws and spread this poison around the nation. We come because people need to understand and know that the same team of ghostwriters were written these killing bill laws of poisoning the constitutional right to vote, while also spreading around the nation these despicable voter ID laws. So we've come because we want the nation to meet the not-so-friendly ghostwriting team headed by Alex, the American Legislative Exchange Council.
My name is Rashad Robinson, and I'm the executive director of ColorOfChange.org. Online civil rights organization in the country, and we work every day to empower Black Americans' voices on the issues most important to us. At the end of last year, we launched a campaign against the American Legislative Exchange Council to take on their work supporting discriminatory voter ID laws around the country. And we didn't just take on ALEC, but we also sent a message to the corporations that sponsor ALEC as well. That you can't come for Black folks' vote. And then you can't then try to come for Black folks' money. Hire us to work harder. Today, we redouble our efforts on the American Legislative Exchange Council. Not just to mobilize against them, but to mobilize against the corporations. With a clear and simple message that Color of Change has continued to put out. That you cannot come for Black folks' money by day, and then try to take away our vote or support laws that take away our lives by night. We will shed a light on the corporation. We will mobilize tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of members to let the corporations know where we stand, and we will not rest until the funding that goes to the American Legislative Exchange Council that supports the efforts to move those bills throughout the country is stopped.
Yes!
Folks who want to join the effort to push back at the money that allows this office to exist, the staff in there to do their work, and the bills to move throughout the states can join us by texting 2012, because we're going to stop this in 2012. They can text 2012 to 30644. They can text 2012 to 30644 and join us in the effort to stand for justice. If racial profiling, intolerance, and racism is the gunpowder, then what ALEC has done with these stand your ground laws is the match.
Justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
My name is Lisa Graves, and I'm the executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy, and last summer... we launched ALEC Exposed because we think the American Legislative Exchange Council must be exposed. What we learned were things like this. This bill, the Shoot First bill, was brought to a closed-door meeting in Grapevine, Texas of ALEC. At that closed-door meeting, politicians and corporations and private sector interests voted behind closed doors to unanimously embrace this law as a model for passage across the country. Walmart co-chaired that meeting.
Oh.
Walmart was the co-chair of the American Legislative Exchange Council's Criminal Justice Task Force at that time, and the NRA's lead lobbyist, Marion Hammer of Florida, who helped conceive of the Florida law and push it through the State House in Florida, was there to present that bill as a model. After that, the NRA became the co-chair of ALEC's newly improved Public Safety and Elections Task Force.
Elections?
Public Safety and Elections Task Force, which approved the voter ID bills that have been steaming through this country. It approved as a model SB 1070. The bill from Arizona that affects immigrants and anti-immigrant legislation.
You could easily get the impression from what the NRA does these days that they're in favor of gun ownership only for white people. It seems like the NRA spends more time lobbying for draconian anti-crime laws, as they call them, than they do lobbying for the right to own a gun. Look at what happened in Washington, D.C. The NRA never challenged D.C.'s gun laws until a bunch of white yuppies started moving into the city, and only then did the NRA file their lawsuits. Are they still the National Rifle Association, or are they turning into the National Racist Association?
But the NRA and Walmart are not the only partners of ALEC. ALEC is bankrolled by Koch Industries. And many other household names, which we have documented since last summer on our site, ALEC Exposed and SourceWatch. They include Kraft Foods, ExxonMobil, and others. These are major corporations, major pharmaceutical companies, and others that you may purchase from.
What the hell is going on when the National Rifle Association, which tells donors they're there to keep their guns from being taken away by the police, is instead lobbying to have the government take the right to vote away from black and brown people? What the hell is going on when Walmart and ExxonMobil are arguing for voter ID laws and are arguing for shoot-to-kill laws in our cities that allow self-appointed neighborhood watch vigilantes to shoot kids like Trayvon Martin down in the street because they feel the slightest bit threatened by someone because they're wearing a hoodie? On the 29th of March, U.S. Park Police, led by Sergeant Reed, a man who had been hassling Occupy for weeks, attacked Occupy D.C.'s McPherson Square information tent, tearing down the tent and violently arresting a woman named Georgia when she tried to retrieve her bag.
So tweet this out, folks. The cops are taking the info tent here at McPherson Square.
You all are just...
What the hell's going on?
They just came in and took the university tent and the info tent.
Yeah.
And they're confiscating all of that. Said that we have to go with proof of ownership.
Really?
Yeah. So I'm gonna have to prove that I own, you know, a tarp, a binder. I'm gonna have to show proof of that somehow. And they tackled Georgia to the ground when she said, "I just want to get my bag," and walked up. And Reed tackled her to the ground, popped her knee out, and they dragged her away to the police.
She's center. Arrested?
Arrested. Yeah. They just arrested Georgia for trying to get her bag.
Freedom of speech. You cannot steal it.
Oh, boy.
You cannot steal our paper, our signs. You cannot steal our tents with messages of hope written on them. You guys have done something very wrong right now. Very wrong. It's not just against the law what you guys just did, and I know you're wearing badges that say something about legal, but like what you did is just against the law, but it's wrong. We all possess the ability to actually speak and express ourselves. Freedom of expression. It's granted by the Constitution, but bigger than that, it is inherent to human beings from our birth. The Constitution states it in writing, but before the Constitution, before the United States even existed, before any government ever existed, we had that right. And it doesn't matter what your badges say, or your guns, or your walkie-talkies, or what you're doing right now, we possess that right.
Two tents taken here, the Occupy University tent and the info tent. I don't know what made them take the info tent. Normally when they take tents here, it's because someone was sleeping in one, or they found bedding material. Judging by the fact that it's noon, I'm sure no one was sleeping in the info tent, and there was no bedding material stored in the park.
Although the raid destroyed Occupy DC's second information tent and a lot of personal property inside and led to one violent arrest, it was not a success. 2 hours after the beginning of the raid, Occupy DC had a new information tent set up, open for business as usual. On the evening of the 29th of March, Occupy DC took to the streets of DC to retaliate for the police seizure of the information tent and arrest of a woman earlier in the day.
And now today, being woke up by being kicked by our fucking Sergeant Reed, and not an hour later shows up in the park and starts barking orders saying he's going to take down the information tent, and he's taking everything in it and confiscating it as evidence.
Evidence of what?
That's what I'm trying to figure out, of what.
And I may still.
And then, when approached by one of the occupiers and asked nicely, "Please, can I just get my bag?" He grabs her and throws her over all the bins that were storage bins full of tent stakes and dangerous sharp objects. One of those bins right there full of tent stakes. Throws her over it, slams her to the ground, and has other officers within seconds put her in cuffs and and drag her that way out of the park. And then she falls because her knee goes out because they're pulling and pushing her.
Yeah.
And then she says, please, I need an ambulance. And they say no and just pick her up and throw her in the back of a cruiser. I'm sorry, man. I have zero respect for any of the law enforcement in this city.
And
in front of the new info tent, the information tent was replaced within 2 hours, but occupiers were fuming. 7 hours after the raid, occupiers marched against traffic in a pattern chosen to maximize disruption in traffic jams. Many were saying, this traffic jam brought to you by Sergeant Reed of the U.S. Park Police, the man who has been harassing occupiers for the past week. Circling! Taking I at 18th now! Some of the protesters even carried fishing poles with donuts tied on a line like bait for a particularly nasty piece of fish.
Out of the sidewalks and into the street!
Out of the sidewalks and into the street!
The most disruptive of the street blockades were when Occupy went in a DuPont circle and blocked both rings of the circle, causing traffic jams to radiate out on P Street, 19th Street, Connecticut Avenue, and New Hampshire Avenue. And later, after another run at Alec, when Occupy DC blocked Logan Circle. At that point, a bus was allowed to pass, but a tank truck full of gasoline was held resolutely by anti-fossil fuel protesters.
Come on, let's let this bus through and stand in front of any car that tries to
follow. Let that bus through. They're gonna let the bus through and block everything else. Block the oil. Bus is allowed to pass, the oil tanker full of oil is being blocked.
DC finally got back to camp, something very interesting had happened. Not only was Sergeant Reed gone for the night, but so was the entire U.S. Park Police, replaced by Metropolitan Police Department for the time being. The Park Police were back, Sergeant Reed included, and made trouble during the Carnival of Resistance. But the information tent, replaced just 2 hours after the Park Pigs took down the old one, was still standing. And as I record this, it's still standing. On the 1st of April, Occupy DC held a 1%er Fool's Day march, marching on corporate targets such as Monsanto, Bloomfield Properties, the so-called owner of Zuccotti Park, Alec, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and many others. DC area anarchists inserted a black block into this march, in large part as a training exercise for upcoming protests at the IMF and World Bank, and at May Day, when a massive general strike has been called for the 1st of May. The black block joined the march shortly before the march arrived at the offices of Bloomfield Properties, the so-called owners of Zuccotti Square.
Bloomfield Property Management!
Bloomfield Property Management!
The 1%!
The 1%!
Would like to thank them!
Would like to thank them!
For kicking those dirty hippies!
For kicking those dirty hippies!
Out of Zuccotti Park!
Out of Zuccotti Park!
We can't have people!
We can't have people!
When March arrived at Monsanto, the people dressed up as billionaires carrying champagne glasses read out an indictment of what Monsanto was doing by controlling the world's food supply, while other people chalked graffiti on the walls of Monsanto's building behind them.
Rolling in on Monsanto, good and quick.
Fuck Monsanto! Fuck Monsanto!
Thanks,
Monsanto.
Thanks, Monsanto.
Monsanto.
Thank you for helping us stay in charge of the food supply.
Thank you for helping us stay in charge of the food supply.
Lots of on your bag, just so you know.
All humans need food to live.
And since they rely on us to feed the world.
And since they rely on us to feed the world.
We are in charge.
We are in charge.
We own the food.
We own the genes.
We own the food.
We own the food.
We own the world.
We own the world.
To our control.
Toast to our control.
To the
1%!
Let them eat cake!
Let them eat cake!
Yeah!
Oh. I know
what comes next.
And especially when it's dinner.
Off with our heads!
Late as usual, we could have done anything in the amount of time it took them to Nice work. Building chalk.
5, 6, 7, 8, we have the money, we
own
the state.
1, 2, 3, nice 4, work. Maybe 1 o'clock, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, we have the money, we own the state.
Cops attacking somebody. One person was arrested in front of Monsanto. He was out in 2 hours. The rest of the march continued. The next target of importance was ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, writer of Florida's Stand Your Ground law and of voter ID laws across the U.S.
Thank you for protecting our
interests. That's front line in front of ALEC, the people the ghost wrote Florida's Stand Your Ground law.
Into
the records.
The records.
Our money.
Our money.
Buys laws.
Like stand your ground.
Which helped racists.
Kill people.
Like Trayvon Martin.
We need
the races in this country.
To be divided.
Two in a row. Bank of America, one of the original targets of Occupy. Occupy Wall Street, Occupy DC, Occupy all kinds of places. Cops set up a defensive line, but it's too far out. It can be flanked. Rolling in.
Here we are.
Flank them. Flank.
There is, in fact, a form of civil disobedience here. That smells like real champagne.
We got sold out.
They're a little worried we turned that corner on Bank of America. We were faster than they were. We were here first. Again, they were slow. There was at least 15 seconds of just protesters and no cops. Guess what that means? After everyone left Bank of America, the black bloc charged 2 blocks south down 15th Street. The block, the intersection of 15th Street and K Street, with a sit-in. The sit-in was only held for a few minutes in order to prevent anybody from being arrested. Before everyone safely returned to camp, and yes, the information tent, the new one put up after the raid on the 29th, was still up and functioning.
So take your feet, you cut my feet, and shove it up your ass! Eat the rich! There's only one thing that they're good for! Eat the rich! Take a one back now, back for more! Eat the rich! I gotta kill this off my chest!
On the 2nd of April, U.S. Marshals showed up at Dawn Butler's home in Northeast D.C. with an eviction order, only to find that Occupy D.C. got there first. Three cop cars and the bank agent showed up, and the agent from Chase Bank acted like he did not want to have to deal with Occupy D.C. By 10:30 a.m., it was being reported that Dawn Butler had obtained a stay of eviction from the court, meaning that Occupy D.C. prevented her property from being forcibly removed prior to the issuance of the stay. J.P. Morgan got caught denying Dawn her legal right as specified in D.C. law when they foreclosed on her landlord to buy the house. Quote, before selling the rental accommodation, the landlord must offer you and your fellow tenants the opportunity to purchase the accommodation. D.C. Official Code 42-3404.02. This represents yet another application of the long-standing principle that direct action can be used to hold ground against frankly illegal destructive activities until others can act. Decades ago, corporate raider George Hurwitz took the money he got from the Texas savings and loans bailouts and used it to buy Pacific Lumber. Pacific Lumber held ownership of what became called the Headwaters Grove, then and now, one of the largest surviving stands of old-growth redwoods in the United States. Like Chase Bank at Dawn's house, Hurwitz played fast and loose with all rules and principle. His plan was to cut and run, meaning clear-cut the forest, bank the money, and leave behind a destroyed forest and an equally destroyed timber industry with no trees left to cut. The famous Redwood Summer led to a decade of direct action by Earth First, and finally the federal government intervened, protecting most but not all of Headwaters. Well, eviction is to homelessness as the headwaters of a stream are to a river. A successful campaign at the headwaters of an issue can prevent far worse problems later. The fight for Dawn's home isn't over, but Chase Bank is going to have much more difficulty getting Dawn out of her house now that their attempt to beat the courts was stopped by Occupy DC. Finish the job! Call J.P. Morgan Chase at 212-552-0054. That's 212-552-0054. And call Rosenberg & Associates at 301-903-8000. That's 301-903-8000. And tell these pigs to leave Dawn alone and stay the hell away from her house. Very short notice. Occupy DC deploying in solidarity with besieged Occupy San Francisco.
We are marching
in solidarity.
In solidarity
with our comrades.
With our comrades
in San Francisco.
In San Francisco.
Who attempted?
Who attempted
to make use?
To make use
of unused property.
Of unused property
for the benefit.
For the benefit
of their community.
Of their community.
Instead of.
Instead of.
The San Francisco police.
The San Francisco police
decided to arrest.
Decided to arrest
80 occupiers.
80
occupiers.
Rather than
help out
anyone in the community.
Anyone in the community.
Whose streets?
We are marching
in solidarity.
In solidarity
with our brothers.
With our brothers.
Sisters.
And allies.
Who in San Francisco?
Trying to take.
A public building.
That formerly had been used.
For mental health services.
For the economically disadvantaged!
It has been vacant! For five years! This weekend! Occupy San Francisco! Try to take! That building back! To use it!
For the health!
Of the people!
They were crushed!
By the state!
In January 2011, the Environmental Protection Agency revoked the Clean Water Act permit for the Spruce No. 1 coal mine, the largest mountaintop removal site in West Virginia. Mountaintop removal coal mining is the process of blowing up mountaintops to access the coal seams underneath and dumping the rocks and earth into valleys below. Citing major environmental damage if the project proceeded, including the burial of miles of mountain streams, this was the first time the EPA had rescinded an already granted permit from the Army Corps of Engineers. On March 23rd, U.S. District Court Judge Amy Berman Jackson ruled that the EPA had exceeded its authority in rescinding the permit. The project is still in limbo because there's a related case working its way through the West Virginia court system. The Obama administration has 60 days to appeal the federal judge's ruling. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Chuck Nelson, a retired underground miner, anti-mountaintop removal activist, and current chair of the board of the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition. He talks about the current state of work atop the mountain and the threats he says the Spruce Mine poses not only to the environment, but to human health and to nearby Blair Mountain, the historic site of a battle between miners, police, and the U.S. Army in 1921.
They did a lot of clear cutting. They hadn't started any blasting or anything like that. And the land, but a historical part that we want to preserve, Blair Mountain, where a battle happened there in 1921 when 10,000 miners was marching to Logan County in order to get better benefits and living conditions for the miners back then to unionize them because it was all non-union. We want to preserve that because it was a significant battle in our history. I mean, it was the largest insurgent military since the Civil War, They even brought planes out and dropped bombs on American citizens, them being the miners. So, you know, this is a big historical area that we would like to preserve. If Spruce would get the permit and go ahead with the mining, it would wipe out the entire battlefield.
What's different about this mountaintop removal site? The permit that was granted by the Army Corps of Engineers and then the EPA vetoed it based on the Clean Water Act. Isn't that situation basically the same for all mountaintop removal sites that have not had their permits revoked?
Yes, a lot of them similar to it, but this one would have been the biggest mountaintop removal site in the state. And it would have buried approximately 30 to 40 miles of stream. And that's when they started looking at that it's causing significant damage to the ecosystem and to the waterways. The ruling that the EPA made was based on that. But there has been a lot happened since then that could further give them more support for their decision. And that is the health impacts. You know, there's been 21 peer-reviewed health studies done. Even now, there's still studies even going on that how detrimental it is to human life, and not only to the ecosystem, but to human life itself. And people that live in and around these mountaintop removal sites.
Chuck Nelson, say a little more about that. Wasn't one showing impacts specifically on pregnant women?
Yeah, it was specifically on birth defects of women. The rate was plumb off the charts compared to other places throughout the nation that women were having birth defects that lived in and around mountaintop removal sites.
Their babies were born with birth defects?
Right, because, you know, you're all the time breathing ammonium nitrate, the explosives that they use, the ammonium nitrate, the diesel fuel, the silica dust that comes from the rock when they blow it up. This all settles right down on the community, in the waterways, and it's causing a lot of people to die, I'll just be honest with you.
The EPA was overruled by a federal judge. Do you want to see the Obama administration appeal the ruling?
I'd love to see them appeal this decision. We haven't heard anything out of the administration as of yet. You know, we're having petitions wrote to the Obama administration, and we talk to the EPA on a regular basis, giving them our support on what decisions they do make. I don't think that President Obama would allow this size of surface mines to go in to southern West Virginia with the impact that he knows that mountaintop removal causes. But, you know, we still have court cases pending that reflect back on that permit. We'll be appealing those, too. So, you know, just because they found a corporate judge to rule in their favor don't mean that they're going to get this permit. They can't override the EPA's veto because the EPA has that power to veto these permits. It's just that in the past, EPA was irrelevant under the Bush administration. And now that, you know, Obama administration has come in and told the EPA that, you know, they're going to have to start doing their job, they had that power to do that. This judge don't understand the consequences of the health studies and what's going to happen to people if this mines is allowed to move forward.
Obama lost West Virginia in the 2008 election. More West Virginians oppose mountaintop removal than support it. So do you think his appealing this would play well for him? I know almost all the state's politicians, including former Governor Joe Manchin, who's now a U.S. Senator, are in favor of mining everything.
Well, the numbers speak for themselves. I mean, there's more people opposed mountaintop removal than are for it. The only ones that you find for it is the people that, you know, work for the industry and the industries themselves. I feel like if he should come out and use his administrative authority and stop this permit, that it would be a plus to him as far as votes in West Virginia.
That was Chuck Nelson of the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition. For more news and analysis on the issue of mountaintop removal coal mining, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.